The lights are on red. We're away.
Welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is Friday, June 13th, 2008, and this is episode number 132. And I am Bob Hayes, your host, here today to talk to you about the most exciting form of motorsport on the planet, the most exciting form of sport in any way on the planet, and that is MotoGP and motorcycle road racing in general. Very, very special shout out. Thank you to Jules Cheesick for taking care of the last couple of shows. I do appreciate it very much. And no, contrary to what an anonymous poster said on the MotoGPOD.com website, I was not in rehab. Thank you very much. Ha ha. But I was down there. I did my Navy weekend. I was down there defending your freedom if you live in the United States at the end of May. And then I had a track day the following week, the first part of June and everything. And it was just like, you know, Jules, say, you want to do the show? And he says, yeah. So it was great. I do appreciate it. Thank you very much, Jules. I thought those shows came out great. So if you didn't listen to number 130 and 131, I encourage you to do so. Jules did a fantastic job, as always, doing the show there. Next thing we got going on, let's see. Let's send a shout-out to Keith Cunningham, Andrew Firth, Rich Glover, George Ninisto, and a very special shout-out to Jim Garrison. All of these gentlemen were so kind as to donate to the worthy cause of MotoGPOD, helping to pay for the bandwidth bill and the Skype call bill, which is actually much more of a concern now than it has been in the past because of the falling dollar. And Jules and I share out on that and everything. And in fact, I need to send Jules some money because he did a call with Liam not too long ago. And I'm sure he's a little bit in the red on that one. I do want to mention that Jim Garrison was kind enough to give me a spectacular donation. Not a PayPal donation. This was an actual in-person donation that I will mention in our call with Darren that we got coming up. And it was beer. So Jim, knowing the way to my heart, gave me 8 different samples of beer and some really, really good stuff. I just finished a Weizenbach, a German beer, a wheat Bach style beer, and it was decidedly different. Had a little bit of a sort of a sweet taste going on and everything, but I enjoyed it very much. Thank you so much, Jim. I do appreciate that. I think you know what fuels the show. So we're going to talk a little bit more about that in the rest of the show, because what we've got going on for this show today, I suppose I should finally get to the point of the introduction rather than just blathering on, is a rather long but I think quite entertaining call with Darren Carpenter, who is our tame Omer racer up there in Portland, and did a call with Darren talking about the Catalunya GP, and we went down and talked about where each rider was at, you know, when they finished the finishing standings and all of that and sort of things, some comments and commentary and just general chit-chat about what's going on with that, the Catalunya GP. I thought that call came out rather well. And it went on rather long, so we're over an hour already on that. And then after that, I've got a commentary, an editorial, if you will, of MotoGPOD goodness, rebuttal to Peter Windsor's comments on Wind Tunnel about passing and saying that if you want senseless passing and overtaking for the lead, that you should go ahead and watch something like motorcycle racing or those sorts of things. Basically saying that passing is unnecessary for racing. So I somewhat have a rebuttal, somewhat actually also an agreement with Peter Windsor, but you'll have to listen to the end of the show for that. And between now and then, we've got the call with Darren, which is actually probably much more interesting than the editorial. So I hope you enjoyed that. And I think that's going to cut it for our intro notes. So why don't we stop this senseless blathering and go ahead and get on with the rest of the show. All right. We got Darren Carpenter on the phone. Darren Carpenter, as you know, is an Omer racer up there in Portland. And we do track days together and he's been on the show before. And welcome to the show, Darren. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. How are you doing, Bob?
I'm doing excellent. Thanks very much. Part of the reason, and why don't we just go ahead and start this off with a little shout out to Jim Garrison, MotoGPOD listener Jim Garrison, who was kind enough to stop by at our track day last week up there at Portland Raceway. And he wasn't doing the track day, but he was going to come down and do some photos and stuff. But the weather was kind of turning rough, and he decided to just sort of stop by and say hello. And he was kind enough to drop off quite a few samples of different beers. And I'm not sure if these are Jim's favorites or just sort of a mixed bag that he picked up. But he brought down like 8 different bottles of beer, and Darren and I sort of shared them out. So thank you very much, Jim. I am sampling right now a Dogfish Head 90-Minute Imperial IPA. And it's a fantastic India Pale Ale. Nice hoppy flavor going on. A little bit of that sort of piney hop taste, but not overpowering. So it doesn't taste like cleanser. It's just got a nice taste. What about you, Darren?
I've got the Bridgeport Old Knucklehead Brewery Barley Ale. Barley wine style ale, which I've never had a barley wine style ale, and I wasn't sure what to expect, and I'm pleasantly surprised. It's actually very good. It's 10% alcohol, so by the time we get down to talking about Marco Melandri, it might not make much sense, but it's very good.
That's okay. You'll be pretty much caught up to me for most of the shows anymore, and it makes you more relaxed. You know, I really think that, like, you know, these announcers, Bob Varsha, especially David Hobbs on the Formula One, that they're drinking pretty heavily during the show. So it makes the podcast a lot easier. But all right, enough tomfoolery. Why don't we talk about Catalunya? We just had our a good race weekend there at Catalunya. 2 races in you know, 1 weekend right after another. Went to Mugello and then went on to Catalunya. And I really enjoyed the MotoGP race. I don't know about you, Darren.
I thought it was really good. You know, Danny Pedrosa checked out right away, and nobody was going to catch him. But the race for second place was very exciting. Rossi had to get by quite a few people to make his way up to second place. And at some points in time, it looked like he might check out. It might not be much of a race, but Casey Stoner came back and it turned into a real banger.
Yes, exactly. I mean, and that's a good way to put it. Why don't we just go down the list? We're not going to do an absolute play by play, lap by lap sort of a thing. We'll just go down the actual final results and make some comments. Race winner was Danny Pedrosa. And like you said, he just checked out. He got the whole shot and pretty much never looked back, led every lap and smashed Hayden's, lap record on the track there, which was set on a 990 bike by like something like half a second, I think, the first time he broke it, and then he broke it again and again.
Yeah, he took off. I'm trying to remember qualifying, and I don't think he was, you know, that stunning in qualifying. I think he was up in the top 2 or 3 in qualifying, but I think they might have found a setting for him that morning at the race, morning of the race, and he was gone. The first, I don't think it was until a lap 11 until he even went into the 143s. He was throwing down 142s lap after lap, and nobody else was doing that except on occasion. And when they did, it was a high 142. And he was consistently in the 142s until lap 11. And then from there, he was just in the very, very low 143s for the next few laps, and he was gone. I think there was a one point where he had like an 8-second gap.
Right, right. And I was kind of wondering, because that was getting fairly late in the race, it still looked like he was pushing and pushing and pushing. And it's like, you know, you've got an 8-second gap here. You might want to, you know, you can put it in maintenance mode a little bit. And he actually did for the last few laps.
He did, but, you know, he didn't, when he was running up front, it didn't even look like he was sliding around. I mean, he just was going, you know, he looked like he was going at 95% and doing those lap times. You know, he looked very comfortable. The bike wasn't moving around. You know, for the first few laps when they were showing him with Casey Stoner in the background, Casey Stoner was, you know, bike was sliding all over the place and he was pushing the front and the back end was sliding around, but Pedrosa was just on rail.
Yeah, that's a good point. He did, he was not getting anything like as out of shape as Stoner was, pretty much all through the race. And that could be a Michelin versus Bridgestone to a point. Trying to think of Rossi's performance also on the stones of looking out of shape or not. And I don't really recall. I noticed that Stoner, definitely, you saw him several times. He was getting very loose and wiggly.
Yeah, and I even think he said something, I made comment about it in the post-race interview about how the first part of the race he just was kind of losing confidence in his tires because he was, you know, the front was pushing, the back was coming around. And again, maybe it's with the Bridgestones. Maybe they take a little bit longer to kind of get warmed up and get settled in where at least Danny Petrosa's Michelins were on rail right from the beginning.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Catalunya is a notoriously low grip track, and it did seem that. And I do remember that now that you mentioned that Stoner said that he didn't have a lot of rear end feel, which is not something you hear racers talk about a lot. Is rear end feel? It's always front end feel. He was.
I mean, it was funny he talked about that. I mean, I know just from experience when the back end starts to move around, it's less concerning. You know, you're more concerned about moving the front end around because when the back comes around, you get more notice. You can do more things to control it, where a lot of times when the front starts moving, you have less time to react.
And it's just kind of a surprise. Next thing you know, you're sliding across the road.
Right. You know, the front goes and you're gone.
Right. So, Pedrosa did have a spectacular race as far as that kind of race is concerned, you know, just checking out and riding lap after lap after lap, which Pedrosa specializes in. He's Kropotkin. If you don't read the Kropotkin Thinks blog, which is excellent at MotoGPMatters.com, and he also posts on Ride On 2, he's got his race reports that go on RideOn2.com. And Kropotkin starts off his Catalunya race report with a comparison about two different kinds of racers or motorcycle racing. He says where there's racers, the riders who love nothing more than to battle with their rivals all race long, only to pass them in the final corner and go on to take the win. And he says, on the other hand, there are the winners, the riders who only care about getting away from the pack and dominating the opposition. The racers love to win by fractions of a second, whereas the winners love to win by minutes. And I think that's somewhat a bit of a simplification, but it's true. You know, you do. There are guys that perform better when they're sort of they've got somebody to battle against, and there's guys that seem to perform better when they're just off doing laps by themselves. And Pedrosa is that kind of guy that if he can break away and not sort of be distracted by the opponents, then he just checked out.
Yeah, and I know people have been waiting to see a battle, you know, on the track in one race between Danny and Valentino. And I don't think we've really seen that yet, you know, because, like you say, Danny, if he has the speed, he's going to check out. Where it seems like a lot of times, if they're equally matched as far as lap times, he isn't one to be able to raise it up a notch or two to take it to the next level to start battling and get the win that way. He's usually can battle for a little bit, but then he'll kind of start fading, you know, towards the end of the race. Not that he does that often. He's finished in the top four, I think, all year long, so he's still doing good.
Right, right. And I mean, you know, I don't want to, you know, I've got my own opinions about Pedrosa and everything, but you do have to admit the guy he's spectacularly talented, but I don't think he's up to Rossi's level as far as being able to race against a guy like Rossi. You know, it would be like Rossi and Gibernau or Rossi and Biaggi, where Rossi just pressures them into making a mistake.
I think Danny's a little bit higher level than Sette or Gibernau, but yeah, I agree. I don't think he's at the same level. I don't think anybody's at Rossi's level. So
no, that's true.
But the championship is tightened up. He's only 7 points behind Rossi now. So
yes,
it seems like there's going to be quite a good battle. There seems to be some battles between Rossi and Pedrosa for the championship, and then a little bit of a gap, and then we've got a battle for third and fourth, and then a little bit of a gap, and we'll talk more about that as we talk down the list here. But
right. Talking about qualifying, Pedrosa had looked to be that he was going to get the pole position during qualifying, and Stoner pulled off just an awesome lap and managed to get pole. So this is obviously before the race. And Stoner got that by, what, 83 one-hundredths. So, you know, it was a close qualifying session, but Stoner was on the pole. And so you've got the two guys that are the classic in the field right now of the, you know, I want to check out and race. And those two guys are battling for the whole shot. So right off the get-go, you knew this was going to be fairly exciting stuff, as you see Pedrosa and Stoner both trying to get the whole shot. And basically, Pedrosa did. And on the rest of the start, there was a couple notable things. One, that Valentino Rossi, who had qualified back on ninth spot, so outside on the third row, not his best qualifying effort. In fact, is actually his worst qualifying effort in quite a while. And Rossi's never been a very, very strong starter. And I'm kind of dancing around all over the place here. But actually, no, because Rossi came in second in the race, so we can go ahead and talk about Rossi. But his start was pretty bad. And Excellent.
Well, I don't think he lost any spots. I think, wasn't he still in ninth place after the first few turns?
Actually, yeah, he was. I think he was like at turn one or so, he might have been in 10th or something like that. And he finished the first lap in 8th. So he picked up spots pretty much right away. But Jules pointed this out in a discussion that I was having with him earlier on via email, that had Rossi gotten a really, you know, if he had qualified better or if he had gotten just a rocketing good start or something like that where he was battling for the whole shot, that the race may have been very, very different. But Rossi had to spend quite a few laps working his way up because it wasn't until on the 9th lap that he took second spot. And
by then, Danny Pedrosa was gone.
Right.
It looked like maybe he was going to try to close the gap and just see what happened, but you could tell he wasn't going to close the gap at that point. And when he started on 9th on the grid, it's really hard to go at MotoGP. It's hard to go from 9th to 2nd, you know, by turn one.
Oh, sure. You have to have that miracle start, which, and we'll talk about Marco Melandri's miracle start a little later. But, and it was a little bit like that. And it's a little disappointing for me because on the ride on two tipping, I picked Rossi to win and Pedrosa for 2nd. But when I was watching the race, I thought I'd picked Pedrosa to win and Rossi for 2nd for some reason. So I was thinking, all right, I picked it. So I was a little disappointed when I realized that I hadn't picked it exactly that way. But so they need a Quinella over there. So you just pick, you know, top two out of the three guys.
Well, actually, I've talking about the ride on two tipping, I picked Pedrosa to win and Rossi to come in 2nd. And I actually picked that, I think, a week before the race started. And the only reason why I did that was Rossi has run 3 in a row, and I thought, you know, I don't think he's going to win 4 in a row, not this year. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, this is Catalonia, it's Spain, I think Pedrosa is going to have something in the bag. And before even they got to the track, I thought, I'm just going to go with that, and I did, and I didn't change it before the race at all. So, you know, that right on two tipping is all guesswork anyway.
It is guesswork.
Every time I change it, I always get it wrong.
I did change mine this time because initially I had Lorenzo on there. And as soon as I heard Lorenzo was out with the concussion, I went up there and changed it because that would be kind of a silly pick. And had he been in the race, it would have been a different story as well, because the Spaniards really tend to shine at their home tracks. Motorcycle racing is so big in Spain, and they really have a huge home field advantage. I mean, the Italians to a point as well. You know, you at Mugello, you're really safe picking Italians to do very well. At any of the Spanish races, you're really safe picking the Spaniards to do well. I think much more so than even like Laguna Seca. You know, Nicky Hayden is certainly not a safe bet at Laguna Seca this year.
No, he was the first 2 years, but.
Right. Well, everybody's caught up. They've learned the track. They've learned the idiosyncrasies. They see that, and I mean, who knows, 2007, if Hayden hadn't had his get together with Hopper, you know, that took the two of the more promising Americans pretty much out of the running right there.
Right. About Rossi, one thing I did want to mention was once he got into 2nd place on lap 9, it was fun to see Stoner catch back up. And when Stoner got around him, and you could see for the last, you know, part of the race, I forget which lap it was that Stoner passed Rossi, but you could see Rossi was just right on Stoner's tail, and it was classic Rossi. You could see he was trying different lines than Stoner, checking out where he could, you know, get an advantage or not get an advantage, seeing what would work better or not work better, and just waiting until the last 3 laps to make the pass. And, at that point, it's kind of too late for Stoner to follow Rossi and pick up a few pointers, because Rossi threw down a fast lap right when he got around him, and then 1 lap more, and that was the race. Which was, you know, classic Rossi style, even though it wasn't for the win, it was for 2nd place, and it was good to see him do that.
Yeah, I agree. Definitely classic Rossi, the stalking and the hunting kind of a thing that he does, and it was good to see. The only thing it wasn't good to see was his leathers with the pink sleeves. That was just gross. But
what was the reason for that, did they say? I don't know.
The livery was supposed to look like the Italian national soccer or football or whatever team, Azuri, and the pink was supposed to represent skin. And I can only assume that Dainese just didn't have the right shade of pink dye or something to make it look anything like actual skin, because it's like, that didn't even look like a sunburn. That looked like just sick. So
yeah.
Sort of a strange candy pink. But
better than his leathers from last year at Aston, was it? That race where he had the him and Colin Edwards had that special Fiat leathery.
And it was that strange shade of green-ish. Yeah, that was bizarre. Yeah.
All fluorescent colors. It was awful.
Yeah, one. That one's pretty brutal. I liked the livery they had a couple of races ago. I thought that one looked good, but yeah. Well, we're digressing. On the finish of their Catalunya, like we said, Rossi came in second, Pedrosa third place, went to Stoner. We've already talked a little bit about Stoner. Had the pole position, but just for whatever reason, you know, the Ducati is not quite the machine compared to the rest of the field that it was last year and all of that, and couldn't quite get the whole shot and couldn't quite get off to as spectacular a start as we've seen from Stoner in the past. So, you know, he had a bit of a battle going on just to get up there. And it did look like he was going to, you know, because he was in second for quite a bit, and there was the battle with Rossi and a battle with Dovizioso, who, you know, we'll talk about in a second as well, and all of that. But he just, I don't know, like you said, you could just see him. He was getting all out of shape on so many of the corners. The rear end was just all over the place that I never really thought that he was going to be able to put it to Pedrosa, just because, again, Pedrosa looked so good and Stoner really looked like he was having to push hard.
Yeah, but, you know, Stoner has finished on the podium in the last 3 out of 4 races, so it seems like they found a setup for that Ducati for Stoner that seems to be working, and he's, you know, he's much more of a threat now for a podium finish than he was the first 3 races of the season, and which is good. You know, it's going to be interesting to see how he does once Lorenzo gets back in the mix, because there'll be 4 of those riders, and we'll kind of see, you know, each one of these riders seems to have a way of checking out for an individual race, but then the race for second seems to be a really good one, and if we can get 3 people in there racing for second, that'll even be a better show.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely. That's true. And that's actually the pattern, like you say, that we've been seeing. And we're now there's, you know, everybody, the death of MotoGP and all of that and the electronics and stuff. But no, I mean, it's just different, you know, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit, kind of an editorial commentary about passing in racing and all that sort of stuff. But, I think it's been an exciting year. I'm having more fun watching MotoGP this year than I think I was last year at this time.
Yeah, I mean, it's been really good. And I think, you know, some of the other variables this year and last year is the fact that the Bridgestone tire is a much improved tire. So, you know, back when it was Rossi and Biaggi and Rossi and Sette, there was less variables. You know, it was either a Honda and Yamaha combination, but everybody was on the same tire, so everybody had to deal with the tire fading the same towards the end of the race, and, you know, tire wear at the beginning of the race, et cetera. Well, now you've got 2 different tire manufacturers, and, you know, I think if you get it in the lead, you're not going to try to kind of just coast. You want to get out in front as far as you can, because you're not sure if your tire is going to last as long as the other guy's tire. You're on 2 different tires. And we've got, you know, 3 different bike manufacturers that are doing in the top 4 this year. So there's more variables going on. So I think if you have a chance to get out and get some space, you're going to go for it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. And actually, especially with the tire wear and tire, you know, just the differences in the tires, that is, and that probably does play into the, certainly the guys like Rossi, where, you know, there's a lot of racecraft, a lot of strategizing, a lot of getting into the other guy's head. And, you know, he's certainly going to be thinking about things like that because it does.
I read an interview with Jeremy Burgess,
yeah.
Rossi's manager, and he was saying that the one thing about the Bridgestones that they liked was the fact that they were strong all the way through the race, and at the end of the race they were just as strong. So, again, I think if you're Pedrosa and you know that you know, Rossi's going to have a strong tire all the way through, and, you know, I'm sure he's confident in his tires as well, but again, you're not going to wait around and see. You're not going to give him any chance. You want to get out and get out in the front as far as you can.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point. I hope that Lorenzo can somebody needs to tell that guy that, you know, well, now we're at seven rounds, going to be round eight coming up, but that, you know, you don't win the whole race weekend in the first free practice. And you know, he's had a lot of crashes in practice the past couple of weeks. Obviously, this week what happened is he had a crash on the Friday and got enough of a concussion going on that he was basically out of the race and taken, you know, in the hospital for observation and all that. He was still in the hospital on Sunday. That combined with his two broken ankles and his messed up hand, he got a skin graft and all sorts of other stuff. This kid's wearing himself out pretty fast. And
and the thing is that with an 18 race schedule at this point in the season, if you hurt yourself, there's a good chance you're going to miss a few races. You would have a break this coming weekend, but then between June 20th and July 20th, I think there's four races. So, you know, if you were to hurt yourself, it's not like you have a few weeks to recover. These are races that are back-to-back, and like you say, you don't want to be taking too many chances in free practice. Nobody wins free practice.
Right. And that's part of the experience and the racecraft sort of a thing that these guys pick up. You know, yeah, if you hurt yourself at Mugello and then you've got Catalunya coming up next week, you know, yeah, you're going to be racing at less than 100%, et cetera, et cetera. So, and that's a good point. And you'll just continue to compound those injuries if you sort of re-injure, you know, any hurt parts and everything. And the season with Lorenzo started off with, you know, such a bang. And he's still, you know, he's had no results from Mugello or Catalunya. But up till then, he was so much on fire. And I'm hoping he'll sort of come back and you know, be able to start putting in some of the effort that he was putting in earlier on in the season so that we can see some of the what he's capable of out there actually during the race. And just to, like you say, to kind of take it easy a little bit in free practice, you know, don't kill yourself, kid. And come on out there.
Well, and I understand, like, you know, as a racer, especially for him, a new racer in MotoGP, if you're able to come out in the first practice and just throw down some fast laps right away, it's kind of like you're giving a signal to everybody else, hey, look, I'm fast right away. You're already trying to catch up to me. There's been a few articles I've read about in AMA with Ben Spies Matt Mladen, sorry about that. You know, they'll talk about those guys. They come out and they're fast right away. They're a second or two ahead of everybody else, and it's just really intimidating for everybody else to know I'm already behind. I need to catch up. But I don't think, you know, he's been around a while. He doesn't have to worry about trying to make a point or prove anything. He doesn't need to come out and be fastest in first practice. But a young guy like Lorenzo, I can see how he's like, yeah, I'm going to throw down some fast laps right away and let everybody know I'm here. But like you say, you know, you need to kind of temper that a little bit because, you know, you don't want to injure yourself in free practice.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, because it is, you know, the whole mental thing. But there's a lot to be said for sandbagging it. And so, you know, and I just maybe Lorenzo, especially once he has already injured himself, maybe he needs to re-strategize as far as that. You know, coming out of the gate, throwing down the gauntlet, I'm a badass. Maybe he should, like I said, take it easy a little bit, do a little sandbagging, and then surprise people. But, you know, he may not have that luxury. We got some classic tracks coming up, though. Donington, Assen, Sachsenring, less so. Laguna Seca is turning into a classic. But, you know, Donington and Assen are both going to be very, very interesting races to watch.
Yeah, but you know those kids nowadays, they just don't listen.
No, they don't. They're terrible. well, all right, going down the results list, sticking to our original plan that's pretty much gone into the toilet. Well, like I said, Pedrosa, Rossi, Stoner on the podium. And now I think the award for, I don't know, surprise of the race or you know, heroic effort of the race or whatever you want to call it, it has to go to Andrea Dovizioso, who came in fourth. And I say that just because I think he did a spectacular job. He really did. You know, Dovizioso is one of our rookies this year that is, you know, and they're all good. But, you know, and this is his second, fourth spot of the year. but I still think he shined through on this race more than he has in the last previous six rounds.
Yeah, this was his second fourth place finish for the year, but he was really hanging in there behind Rossi and Stoner for most of the race. It wasn't until the last bit when Rossi and Stoner really started putting it to each other that he kind of lost touch with them. I mean, for the most part, you could kind of see him in the background, and he was maybe a tenth or two slower each lap, but, you know, he was still pretty much in contact with them, not in a threat any kind of way, but he was still in the picture.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and, you know, all it takes is one good mistake or one bad mistake, depending upon your point of view, who you are, you know, on Stoner or Rossi or even Pedrosa's part or whatever, and, you know, Dovizioso would have been on the podium, that sort of thing. Towards the end of the race, the gap was big enough that even, you know, it had to been a big mistake. But
that's how he got second place to begin with. He was behind Stoner. Stoner looked like he lost the front, or maybe the back end came around. He went wide, and so he was right there to take advantage of that and was in second place, and then Stoner had to get back around him.
Right, and that in itself is a valid, respectable race strategy. You know, you may not be able to, let's say it for what it is. You may not be able to pass Stoner on completely equal terms, but, you know, Stoner makes a mistake, you're there to take advantage of it. Then you can prevent him from passing you, because it's a little easier to defend than to be on the offensive. And
that is a good race strategy. I mean, I think that was one of the things that Rossi did to Stoner towards the later part of the race when Stoner passed Rossi was, you know, Rossi was right on his tail, and you could see that he could have passed him at any point, but you could also probably imagine Rossi's thinking, you know, I'm just going to push you and see if you make a mistake, because the easiest way to round you is if you go wide.
Right, right, exactly. And I think Dovizioso did a spectacular job, and again, showing, you know, these guys are experienced racers. I mean, they've been doing it in the 125s and the 250s for such a long time, and I have to admit my ignorance of the 125s and the 250 series is apparent, so I can't tell you off the top of my head if Dovizioso took a 250cc championship or not, which is pretty bad considering I'm the guy on MotoGPOD. And I'm kind of flipping through my little pink book here real quickly, but in any case, what's that?
I'm not good on a 250 series, so I can't remember if he did either. But one other thing about him is he's on, Team Scott, and he's a solo rider on that team. And so unlike Colin Edwards and James Toseland, who they are both on the same team, and it's pretty obvious they're helping each other out and helping each other learn the tracks, he doesn't have anybody to do that. He's just on his own team working himself. So
That's
also commendable.
Right, right, exactly. Especially, again, and I've said this one before, you know, what Team Scott was, Konica, Minolta, Honda, et cetera, JIR Racing, all that business. This was the team where racers went to retire. You know, this is the old folks' home of MotoGP. And I think that Dovizioso has certainly turned that around. And I know he brought a lot of his own guys along with him, his crew chief and all that sort of thing. But they've certainly turned that team around. And that's, you know, good for him. Because now, let's see, where is he in the world champion? He's sixth right now.
Kind of a bunch there. If you look down the championship, Colin Edwards has got a kind of a comfortable gap in fifth place, but then between sixth and ninth, I think it's only separated by 9 points. So
it's
going to be interesting to see who comes in sixth place in the championship, and not to say that he's not going to even finish in fifth, but right now they've got kind of a pack there with James Toseland and Caparossi, Nicky Hayden bringing up the rear. But it'll be interesting with those guys to see who, you know, starts pulling it through. He would even be higher, but he's had, I think he crashed once or twice, and he had a China result was kind of a low result, and I think he also DNF'd in a result. So he would be even higher up in that list if he hadn't had those two bad finishes.
Right, right. And, you know, and this is how you win championships, consistency and all of that sort of thing. Because it's getting to the point now where our two points leaders in the championship, Rossi and Pedrosa, who are starting to break away a little bit. I wouldn't say, you know, with 7 out of 18 rounds done, a, 48-point lead. That is not a commanding lead, but it's, you know, it's a pretty big gap. And Rossi and Pedrosa are the only two guys that have scored points in every race. I'm looking to double-check that I am correct, and I am correct as I scan down this. You know, and that is the kind of thing that wins championships. So, It's going to be a good one, and it is. I said this earlier in the season, that this is not going to be settled like it was last year, where, I mean, pretty much by even Sepang, it was relatively a done deal. It may not have been a mathematical, you know, Stoner is going to win the championship, but for all intents and purposes, the championship was fairly much over for the last almost a third of the season. Not, you know, last 25% certainly. I think this one's going to go down to the last couple of rounds before we really know who's going to be the champion.
But there is still, I guess, 10 rounds, 11 rounds to go. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I still wouldn't be surprised if Danny Pedrosa or Valentino had a DNF for one reason or other, mechanical or a crash. And so there's still a lot of racing going on. But, yeah, you're right. It's turned out so far that it's those two battling for the championship. They are separated by 7 points. There's a pretty big gap down to third place. Lorenzo and Stoner are pretty closely matched for third. I think there's a 4-point difference between the two. But, yeah.
2 points, and only two.
Two-point difference.
And that's not, I didn't mean to come across saying that now it's between Pedrosa and Rossi, because I agree that, you know, it only takes one DNF for those guys each, realistically. And, you know, a couple bad results, et cetera, et cetera. You know, the possibilities are endless. And Lorenzo and Stoner are right up there with them again. That's why I'm saying it's not a commanding lead. They've right now, yeah, there's a bit of a gap going on, and it's sizable in points, but there's so many races left that both Stoner and Lorenzo certainly have a chance to make up that gap and become, you know, legitimate contenders again.
Well, let's go down the list here. So we've got DeBoso in fourth, and now we've got Colin Edwards in fifth, and I think he did a really good race in this getting in fifth place.
I think so too. Edwards has somewhat, I don't want to say saved his career, but he has certainly somewhat like reignited it.
I think he saved his MotoGP career.
There you go.
I mean,
yeah.
Before the season started, people were kind of thinking that it was a gift to Edwards, put him on this Tech 3 team. You know, he's done his time. He's put in his miles with Michelin. And so it was kind of like, hey, let's give the guy one more season. You know, let him go out on a kind of a swan song before we let him go. And he's got fifth place in the last two races and a third place in France. You know, he's really doing good.
Right. And I agree. He saved his MotoGP career is a good way to put it, because he's being discussed. And there's a couple articles by Dennis Noyes that showed up on the Speed TV website that I'm going to put links to in the show notes. And I probably should have prepped you for this. Sorry, Darren. But he kind of goes down all of the racers and saying, you know, at this point right now, and this article was written like a week ago, that there's about 6 out of the 18 that are assured a seat next year. And the other 12 it's up in the air. We're already getting into silly season, and you've got, you know, 12 guys wandering around for, well, 13 guys wandering around for 11 chairs, that kind of a thing, or 12 chairs. So Colin Edwards has certainly, like I said, reignited his career, and he's being talked about for a variety of different spots of where he might end up. And they're all, you know, they're somewhat viable. Just, you got to read the article by Dennis Noyes. He's got some excellent points of like, well, if this happens, then we'll see that, you know, that kind of a thing going on, that's why they call it silly season, because it is a bit silly at this point, to be predicting who's going to be racing in the 2009 season when we start racing in March, you know?
And I did see something about Colin Edwards talking to, I don't know if it was Kawasaki or Ducati about a ride next year. And, you know, just to guess, I would imagine that Colin Edwards is happy at where he's at with Tech 3. But, you know, if you're Colin Edwards, you're going to look at every option you have. There's no guarantee that Tech 3 is going to, you know, give you a contract next year either. And, you know, just in general, it's not even MotoGP, but just, you know, in general, you want to kind of see what all your options are out there and take the best one that's for you. And,
right.
You know, I'm not surprised at all that he's talking to Ducati and Kawasaki, and who knows if there's actually going to, you know, lead to anything, but you got to see what's out there. And yeah, I think he's going to be around next year.
Oh, I agree. And the thing is also, let's face facts, Colin Edwards is getting older, and he's at that point in his career where it's like, yeah, I mean, and I can more respect this from a guy like Colin Edwards of like, I'm going to follow the money. You know what I'm saying? Because he's got a limited number of years of this available. And, you know, he needs to do the best he's got with the last few years, basically build up his bankroll, build up his resume, so to speak, so that he can line up something for after MotoGP. Because as we've seen from Max Biaggi and Carlos Checa and all that, there is a life in motorcycle racing after MotoGP. And even if he doesn't go back to World Superbike, which in some ways, I doubt Colin Edwards would go back to World Superbike unless it was a really sweet deal. But there's a lot of other opportunities as well. You know, being commentator, all sorts of stuff that he can go do. And you know, the guy's got a family, he's got a lifestyle and all of that. And, you know, I think he's earned the big bucks that he makes. And, you know, so more power to him.
Yeah, and then talking about him being a commentator, I think he's well-liked in the media tent as well. So I don't think we're going to see Edwards disappear into the sunset. I think he's going to be around for a very long time.
Yeah, he's extremely charismatic. He's very, very comfortable with you know, crowds and cameras and the press and all of that sort of thing. He would be a good guy to see doing that sort of a job. So he did come in fifth at Catalunya. And that puts him in fifth in the Riders' Championship after Catalunya. Actually, I think he was sixth. So he picked up a spot because he was sixth after Mugello. So he advanced a spot. Good for him. But sixth place in Catalunya went to James Toseland, who's another one of our rookies for MotoGP, although certainly not a rookie for motorcycle racing. And his race, I don't think we got to see enough of James Toseland on the broadcast.
No, we didn't. Looking at the lap chart, he actually, I think Hayden was in, Toseland and Caparossi, or Toseland and Vermeulen, both passed Hayden, I think, with the last lap or last two laps to move up a little bit in that chart. We didn't really get a good enough coverage of them. Unfortunately, if they're behind sixth place, you don't really get to see them on TV much. They don't really show that. One thing as a side note about the coverage, I will say, I almost threw my remote control through the TV because I don't think this was a fault of Speed Channel either. I think it was the MotoGP broadcast. But when Rossi passed Stoner with only two laps left, I mean, while they were battling, while Rossi was following Stoner, they showed just basically Rossi and Stoner the whole time, which was great. That's where the battle was, and that's what I wanted to watch. And then with three laps left, Rossi passes Stoner, and immediately they show the back end of Pedrosa on his bike cam going around for about half a lap. Then they show the stands. Then they show the stands again. Then they go back and show Edwards and Toseland and Vermeulen. And I was just furious. I wanted to see Rossi and Stoner, and they didn't show it hardly at all.
Yeah, I agree. It bugs me every time. And I was thinking about this as I was watching the race, that I have to mention this again, the classic Bob Hayes gripe. And okay, Pedrosa is due his, you know, moment in the sun, his fame. You know, this is his race. He's winning it. We've got to see Pedrosa crossing the line. But for God's sake, have you people not heard of Picture in Picture? I mean, put a little quarter of the screen to show me what's going on for second and third position while we see Danny Pedrosa cross the finish line and do his victory wheelie and all that goodness. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I
agree.
It drives me nuts.
I was about to throw my remote control through the TV. Yeah. And it was the only thing that saved me from having a stroke was the fact that once Rossi got around Stoner, it looked like he did kind of check out a little bit. He did throw down a fast lap, so there wasn't really much of a battle there. But, oh my goodness. I swear my heart was about to split open.
I agree. I know. And I knew it was coming, too, as you on those last, certainly the last lap and everything, and you're seeing Pedrosa, and they're showing more and more Pedrosa and stuff, and it's like, oh, my God, what's happening back there, you know? And I guess if you're watching the full version of the MotoGP feed, if you're watching it online or if you're in Europe or what have you, you can kind of count on a replay, at least, after the race. Over here in America, if you watch it on speed, you can't count on that. You know, you kind of get what you get. And I know. It always gives me a little bit of a heart attack, too. But so it's, you know, it's, we need to go to Kelly's Olympic one of these days. I'm going to come up to Portland and we'll go watch a race at Kelly's Olympic because I want to do that. And just to jump up and down and scream at the TV together. I was like, damn it, man. So, all right, going down the list, like we agree, we didn't see enough of Toseland. Toseland is a Actually, well,
it seems like, you know, if you compare him to Edwards, it seems like the last two races he's finished behind, actually the last three races he's finished behind Edwards. I think the France race he had DNF'd. But, you know, he's doing good. I mean, he's, you know, he's had some bad results. He's had some good results. I think he's doing better than anybody expected. A fifth or sixth place, I think, is a really good spot for him. And I think these tracks, you know, it's a new season for him. He's on a new bike, and a lot of these tracks he hasn't raced at before. And I think somebody even said at this particular track he either hadn't raced here before, maybe it was a track before, but, you know, he was getting help from Colin Edwards, kind of learning the lines. And, you know, I know some racers probably go to a track and can pick it up right away. I'm not like that. I'm assuming that, you know, even in MotoGP, some of them are better than others as far as picking up a track when they first go there. And, you know, a lot of these tracks have corners you just don't ever see anywhere else. They're very unique, individual kind of tracks, and he's doing very good. You know, it'll be interesting to see how he does next year with the 1 year experience under his belt.
I agree, and I do think that the other rookies this year, you know, if we're going to call them MotoGP rookies, they have one up on him because they all came up from 250, and they've all been to all these places before. So somewhat the test of that will be Laguna Seca, where the 250 guys have not been. So, you know, right. Lorenzo, Dovizioso, and DeAngelis have not been there. Now, Toseland around at World Superbike?
He was there with World Superbike. It's been a few years, but I think 2003 or 2004 was the last time World Superbike was there. And he was there, I think, at least 2 or 3 years before they stopped going to Laguna Seca.
Okay.
And Laguna Seca is a kind of a unique track. It just doesn't match up with the big tracks that you find over in Europe. You know, the track's not as wide. It's not as not as much runoff. You're not at the same high speed. It's more of a country road than it is a big track. If you want to compare it between the European tracks and the U.S. track,
right. Certainly compared to the tracks like Catalunya, and even actually against the real country road tracks like Assen and Donington, Laguna Seca is quite a bit different. And you know, and the corkscrew and all of that can definitely catch people out. So that'll be interesting to see, actually, as sort of a prediction of, you know, will Toseland beat out Dovizioso, Lorenzo, and DeAngelis as far as being, you know, in the rookie cup sort of a thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and plus, you know, it's not a high-speed track a lot of times. I don't think they even use I know they changed the gearing for Laguna Seca, but I think a lot of the racers only use five gears. They gear it for five gears. You don't ever have a big long straightaway where you need to get up in speed. So he won't have a disadvantage between the factory Yamaha teams and his, you know, satellite team.
Right. Which seems to be closing this year anyway. All right, moving on down. Chris from Mulan. Got any comments on Chris?
I don't. I didn't really see much of him as well. I know that he was, I believe, in a battle. And if you look at the gap, I think he was right behind Toseland. I think it would have been interesting to watch that battle.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't get to see it on TV. And both of those guys passed Hayden in the last few laps. And Vermeulen, you know, I would have thought Vermeulen would have done a little bit better. He's not like his first year on Suzuki. He's been there for a while. But, you know, the Suzuki seems to have been a little bit of a disappointment. But I don't know if it's just because Yamaha has improved more than everybody expected. Danny Pedrosa on the Honda has improved more than everybody expected as far as comparing them to the Ducati. We didn't really see much of Vermeulen.
I think, I think that's what it is that last year there was a little bit more parity. And this year that the Honda for Pedrosa has improved by leaps and bounds. The Yamaha in general has improved by leaps and bounds. The Ducati has improved by like leaps, but maybe not bounds. And somewhat the Suzuki and the Kawasaki are still just not quite there. And, Kawasaki's talking about, you know, doing things like going to a 5-cylinder configuration and things like this, that we're reading rumors about, because it's just not quite there. And they've been running what's called a screamer instead of a big bang engine. They're not finding the power, and that is showing. And I think Suzuki is somewhat having the same problems. Too many resources going to AMA. Now, here's a good point. I don't know if you heard this one, but another one of the rumors going around is that Suzuki is so upset with this whole Daytona Motorsports Group business going on the AMA side that they're saying they're not going to be here next year in AMA.
I wouldn't be surprised at all. I mean, we don't have any real solid details. At least I don't know of any solid details what's going to happen with AMA. But from what I have heard and from what I can understand, I wouldn't be surprised if all the factory teams pull out of AMA next year. Suzuki being, you know, the one that has the most to lose because they've dominated so much in the last 7 years. But yeah, I wouldn't be surprised at all if they pull out of that. We can talk more about that if you want towards the end here, but yeah, the AMA is changing a lot next year, and you know, I think the person that loses the most with that, as far as with Suzuki, is Matt Mladen. He's too old to get a ride in MotoGP. It'll be interesting to see if he goes to World Superbike or somewhere else, or if he just retires and does some, you know, testing or something like that. Ben Spies, I think, is pretty much, maybe not a lock, but he's going to do some test rides for MotoGP in the U.S. tracks, and the Suzuki has really expressed an interest with him in MotoGP. But, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised at all if they pull out of that. And if they do, it'll be more resources they put towards somewhere else. If it's either MotoGP or World Superbike, it's hard to say.
Exactly, exactly. And I agree. From what I've heard a little bit, not to keep going down the AMA path, but from what I've heard is that there's at least two factories that are just flat out pissed. And a couple other factories there are somewhat agreeable. But yeah, well, I need to do my homework more on that whole thing. But so much of it is rumor right now anyway. So there's really not a lot of homework that you can do that's anything reliable. So that's kind of a tough one. But we'll talk about that more. But in any case, if Suzuki were to free up some money and be able to put some more money into their somewhat underfunded, notoriously underfunded MotoGP effort, that would be a good thing. And it would be a good thing for Vermeulen and for, well, probably not Lawrence Caparossi next year, possibly, but whoever it is next year. So, eighth spot, Nikki Hayden. And, you know, I've been taken to task a little bit in my emails and things like that for Hayden bashing. Because, as you guys know, I'm a pretty big Nikki Hayden fan. I've never made much of a secret about that. I think he's a great guy. I think he's a very, very good racer, very talented. But it's more, I don't know, there's just something, you know, he's very charismatic or whatever. And I just sort of like Nikki, and I like to root for Nikki. Here's a guy who started on the front row, first time on the front row this year. He qualified third. He was, a quarter of a second behind Stoner, which is actually, it was a very good qualifying effort. And he finishes eighth. And it's just sad to see.
Yeah, but, you know, looking at the qualifying, the free practice one and two, I don't think he was up near the top. I was kind of surprised that he qualified as well as he did, which might be more of a testament to the qualifying tires that Michelin has. And, you know, I've heard some message, you know, some stuff going back and forth on the boards in the last few races as far as Nikki Hayden fading as the race goes on. And a thought that came through my head was that, you know, let's say, for example, Valentino Rossi. Valentino Rossi, he starts a race off in ninth place, and he works his way up and finishes in second place. And I think he has this confidence and the knowledge that as the race goes on, he's going to be fast, he's going to catch up to people. He's not so concerned about getting to the front, you know, on the lap one and turn one, as much so as somebody who isn't running as fast. And so I think if you're Nikki Hayden, you know, look, I got to get up to the front as fast as possible. If I don't get up to the front, I'm not going to have, you know, I don't have the confidence, I don't have the speed to work my way up through the pack. And so I think he's, you know, does some good starts. He takes some really bold moves going into turn one. You know, he'll pass like three or four people. He'll run wide and then get passed by one or two, you know, one other person. But still, overall, he makes up some gains and he gets up to the top five, it seems like, for the first laps. But then kind of fades back. And I think that's just because, you know, he's riding over his head. You know, he's riding at 105%, 107% of whatever he has in him. And you can only do that for a few laps. Before you just start, you know, you just can't do it forever, or you're going to crash.
Right.
And so I think he just doesn't have it in him. And I think there's been a lot of people that have been coming up in MotoGP that have just got the skills. And I wish Nikki Hayden would do better. It would be interesting to see if he went to a different team. I don't think this is his last year in MotoGP. And just like we've seen Colin Edwards have a turnaround in his career this year, I wouldn't be surprised if Nikki Hayden went to a different team and found a good, you know, match with the team and bike and tires and did better next year. I hope he does. I'm a fan as well. But yeah, he seems to be kind of just, you know, doing as good as he can, finishing in the top 10.
Right, right. It's a little sad to see Hayden being beaten by satellite teams. And he's a bit of a victim of the Honda factory Honda-ness, where, you know, they built Danny Pedrosa a motorcycle. And right. Yeah, and I mean, they've done this in the past. They've done it for Mick Doohan. They did it for Freddie Spencer. They did it in the 250s for who was it? But I know that Sebastian Porto was the guy who got screwed on that one. You know, and that sort of thing, where it's like, you know, we're going to basically put all our eggs in the Danny Pedrosa basket, and let's build this little tiny motorcycle. And if you're 5 foot, you know, 8 or 10, or, you know, which Hayden's fairly tall. He's what, 5'8", 5'10", 5'11", that kind of range. And, you know, 155, 160 pounds, which is big for MotoGP. You know, you're too big for this motorcycle. And that is Hayden's problem as much as anything. Plus, I'm not 100% sure how much he's adapted beyond his dirt tracker style, which does not work with the 800s.
No, and but it's hard to say. I mean, he's been in MotoGP for a while now. And
what, 4 or 5 years, yeah.
You know, it's, like I said, you're right. They kind of built that bike for Danny Pedrosa. And I think Honda in general, just from, you know, when I've been watching MotoGP, they have, the factory Honda has an idea of what their bike should be and what their rider should be, and they build the bike for that purpose. And I think even when Rossi was at Honda, he kind of didn't like the fact that he couldn't call the shots. They were going to build the bike that they wanted to build, and he needed to race it.
Right.
And I think they've said, hey, we're going to build a bike. We think Danny Pedrosa is the rider, you know, of the future, the size of rider, you know, like a jockey, basically, very small guy. And I think for Nicky Hayden, unfortunately, he's just kind of been caught out. He doesn't fit that mold. And, you know, maybe, like I said, it would be. And I also kind of think that he's just maybe taking some hits on his confidence. I've said before that the longer you go without success, the harder it is to be successful. And, you know, I can only imagine, you can only insulate yourself so much from the media before you start to pick up on all of these things about what they're saying as far as how you're not doing well, and, you know, the satellite teams are doing better and DeBosio's doing better. And, you know, eventually that's got to hit on your confidence. And it's, you know, he's done very well for 5 years, and he's won a championship 2 years ago. But, you know, I think eventually it's just got to kind of wear on you the same way it's got to be wearing on Marco Melandri on a different level, because Marco Melandri is further behind even Nicky Hayden. But,
right.
You know, I think it's just hard on your confidence, and motorcycle racing is all about your confidence.
Right. And I think that's a very, very good point. I mean, yeah, you know, these guys, they read the internet, they see the news, they're not isolated that much. They do know. So moving down the list,
I don't really have much more to say about anybody else on the list, except maybe make a few comments. Of course, Randy DePugna crashed out again.
RDP, it can be relied on to be
crashing. I need to get into the habit of picking him every race to be the first out, because then I might actually win some points on that tipping contest.
It's hard. It's hard to get out of that trap of automatically picking Randy DePugna to be the first DNF. and see, actually, this time you would have not, you know, he was the third DNF, so you know, would have not have gotten the points. But let's touch on real quick, you know, Shinya Nakano. He's I don't know, you might call him the ghost rider this year. You haven't heard squat about Shinya Nakano. He's quietly gone off to you know, the Gresini team, which is what, San Carlo Honda Gresini this year. And he's having a very mediocre season.
Yeah.
He screwed himself big time by leaving Kawasaki.
Right.
Say again?
Well, I mean, the Kawasaki riders aren't doing much better this year, so I don't know.
No, they're not. But, but had he at least stayed there, he would have had the loyalty points. So he came in 9th. John Hopkins came in 10th. Now, Hopkins qualified... Where did Hopkins qualify? He qualified 12th, so he... No, scratch that. I take that back. Hopkins qualified 14th. So he picked up 4 spots in the race, but you had 4 DNFs. So,
right.
Yeah, all of whom were in front of him.
And I would have expected more this year from Hopkins. I know he started off the season injured, so the first few races it was like, okay, you're injured. I understand it's hard to develop a bike and hard to race a bike when you're injured, but this is race 7, and he's still finishing. You know, he's battling for a top 10 finish and not even getting that sometimes, and right. It's disappointing that, you know, Hopkins, I think, you know, the thing about Hopkins is the first few years he was in MotoGP, nobody expected anything. And he did better than his teammate, and he did better than what people were expecting. You know, he got a few podiums. He, you know, people would see him in the top five, and they're like, wow, he's on a, you know, Suzuki. It's not a good bike. But now it's kind of like people are expecting a little bit more from him. And
he's not delivering.
He's not delivering.
Now, they did mention Nick Harris, our MotoGP commentator, said something about, you know, the injured John Hopkins. And I know I was like, well, I hadn't heard about a new injury. Is he still talking about the injury from before the season started?
I don't know.
Yeah, see, I hadn't heard if there was a fresh problem or not, and I probably should have done my homework on that one. But yes,
I don't think there is. I think it's
like I said, it didn't pop up very high on the radar. If it's true, he is doing much better than his teammate.
but it's getting closer and closer, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's true too. And why I continued, I wanted to go down the list, was let's talk about number 11, Marco Melandri. And we mentioned this a little bit earlier in the call. This is a classic example of how far the mighty have fallen, because Marco Melandri is so much better than what he's doing here. And the thing is it's sad because, I mean, you can see the guy's career literally swirling around down the toilet. You know, because he's not on the list on Dennis Noyes's list of guys that have a seat next year. His results have been, you know, mediocre at best. He got in China, he got a 5th, 11 points.
Yeah, but there was a lot of DNFs in China, and
exactly.
China also had like a wet kind of start. You know, that was really kind of a random race.
An anomaly. Yeah. But I mean, he's just, you know, he's only got 29 championship points compared to three times that many from his teammate on the same motorcycle. This has got to hurt, because this is a guy who's better than this. And we've said this in other calls. And, you know, I'm not a huge – it's not like Marco Melandri's my favorite guy or anything like that. But I know he's better than this. And it's just sort of sad to see.
Right, and you know, I was talking about Marco Melandri. I remember last year, I forget what track it was, but he won the race, and I want to say it was Phillip Island, and I want to say it was that strange rain race where they came in and pitted halfway through. But I remember I actually had a link to it for a long time on the last lap, last turn, where he's smoking the rear tire with his, you know, giving a peace sign as he's coming around the last turn for the win. And how far has he fallen since then? I mean, that was like the most confident rider. He was on top of the world, just having a blast. And this year, he's just lost all confidence in that bike. And like I said, racing is all about confidence. And then once you start losing that confidence, it's just hard to regain it. And then to see your teammate on the exact same bike doing so much better, you've just got to start questioning yourself and questioning your ability. And it's just really hard to come back from that.
Yeah, and I think that must be part of it, too. I mean, he qualified in 16th for this race, but he got, like, in this incredible start. I mean, he was way, way up there to – where was he on the lap chart? Let me flip through my lap chart real quick, because he was just comparatively speaking, at the end of the first lap, he was 10th. So from 16th to 10th. You know, I mean, that's a good start, but he immediately started fading. And just, you know, whatever. And then he finishes in 11th spot, which, like I said, because of the four DNFs, is he pretty much didn't make a whole lot of progress.
Right, and so. I mean, if he's not, you know, who knows if he's back next year. I hope he is. I could see him succeed. You know, he's a really good guy, but... if he's not back next year in MotoGP, it's going to be like, I've never seen somebody fall off MotoGP so fast.
Right, right. And that
not a previous winner, not a previous race winner.
Right, Exactly. And that's actually touched on in the Dennis Noyes article. So I don't want to pretend like this is my own opinion that I made up and stuff, but that he's burned bridges with Grassini. He described like the bike that he was riding with Grassini is the worst motorcycle he's ever ridden and stuff like this. And it's like, that might've been a mistake. You know, because unless there's some weirdness at say like the Tech 3 Yamaha team, you know, they're not likely to pick him up. Honda is well known as a team that once you're done, you're done. You're not coming back. And so any of the Honda satellite teams, because look at Biaggi. So, you know, I don't know where Melandri can go. And that's actually a real good reason to read the Dennis Noyes article right there. Going down the list, we might as well finish him up. We're almost done. Ant West, he's our favorite rider to pick on this year. Probably the guys that shouldn't have a MotoGP ride. That's harsh to say, but in some ways I think it's true with Ant West. I think that although he did real well and he sort of earned that ride, that maybe that was the anomaly. And now he's showing more or less his true somewhat colors. And it's just, wow. I mean, not only not performing, but not even sort of being very good in the press about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And, no, I wouldn't be surprised at all if he's off to the British.
Oh, he'll be gone soon. Yeah. Yeah. He's history. And I mean, realistically, you know, Chaz Davis, deserved a MotoGP ride more than Ant West or even, you know, let's get Hoffman back or one of those guys. I don't know. It's just never been one of my favorite guys, and I hate to be negative like this, but it's just you read what he says, and even the quote machine, whereas Kawasaki is writing for this guy, and they still can't make him sound all that great. It's just wow. Sylvain Guittoli finished 13th, picked up 3 points there for Alice, and you know is a wow. He was a long way down, 1 minute behind Danny Pedrosa. And then our DNFs were RDP, classic Randy DePugne. We were spared, at least on the Speed TV transmission, we were spared the agony of seeing Randy DePugne with his leathers off, which I know is a disappointment for Grace over at Formula One blog.
If any listeners have a photo of that, email them to Bob and he'll forward them on to Grace.
You know, that's not funny. You know how many emails I get of like half-naked men? And it's like, I don't need this. I got one of James Toastland like dancing in his underwear. And it's like, I don't need this. Thank you very much, people, for no more naked men pictures. It's Grace. Send up to Grace. Go to formulaoneblog.com, find her email address, and harass her with the half-naked writer pictures. It is a good joke that continues to please, though, RDP joke. And Alex DeAngelis, one of our promising young rookies, who is at, where is he at in the championship? 14th. With a 24 points, he's only scored points in 4 races. So he's the least promising of our promising young rookies. Yeah. You gotta start somewhere. And he is, I don't know, actually, I mean, it's kind of, he's, cause Nakano's doing considerably better than he is on the same team. So Alex DeAngelis doesn't seem to be having a very good year. And I think he's more capable, judging from what I saw in the 250s that I recall, from him. I'm a little, I don't really know what to say about the guy. You know, I haven't followed it closely enough. I haven't read up enough on his issues and all of that sort of thing to have much of an opinion other than the sort of blanket thing of saying, wow, he's not doing that well.
I don't have an opinion either.
Yeah. And Sylvain Guittoli, who along with Ant West, and let's be, you know, brutally honest here. I've actually met and talked with Sylvain Guittoli. He's a nice guy. And I'm not saying, you know, that, you know, anything, I don't want to say bad things about him is what I'm saying. But if there are two guys in MotoGP right now that barely deserve to be there, it's Ant West and Sylvain Guittoli. And, you know, I think he's talented and all of that, but he's not doing very well on the Ducati. He was having a better year last year on the Tech 3 team with the Dunlop tires. And now he's on virtually a factory Ducati on the Bridgestones, and he's got slower lap times.
Well, and that's the thing. When you look back last year, when he's on the Dunlops, you don't expect anything.
Right. So he did great.
If you do any kind of result, it's like, wow, he's doing really well. And so once you move up to a team where you're started to be expected to get some better results, if you don't produce them, you know, there's just not that many rides in MotoGP, and there's a lot of talented riders out there.
Right. And, I mean, you know, this is the harsh, brutal reality. You have 18 seats in you know, to fill here. You're looking for the 18 best motorcycle riders in the world. And, of course, unfortunately, there is politics involved no matter what, but that's fine. We can understand that. You can still find some good guys. And when Ben Spies next year, Sylvain Gattoli, Ant West, those are the guys that are going to be getting out in order to make room for Ben Spies.
Right.
Somehow or another, however the musical chairs game sorts itself out. Then our last guy that we got to talk about. Oh, no, wait. Wait a minute.
Well, we got Lewis Caparossi, and he had a DNF. I can't remember where he was at on what lap. I think he was in the top 6 or 7, wasn't he, when he went out?
Yeah, and I'm puzzling myself of how I went from Gattoli to the DNFs, but whatever. Yeah, Lewis Caparossi. He was having a pretty good race.
He's starting to show a little bit more promise on that Suzuki. They're starting to come along a little bit better. You know, I kind of compare him to John Hopkins on the Kawasaki, since they kind of both switched teams, and I'm trying to track both of them to see how they're doing. And it seems like Lewis Caparossi is doing a little bit better on that Suzuki than John Hopkins is doing on the Kawasaki. But I also kind of go with the fact that, Lewis Caparossi, he's been around for a long time. He's proven that he can adapt to a different machine, more so than John Hopkins has. John Hopkins has been around for a little bit of time, but he's always been on the same machine. And one thing about these guys that have been around for a long time, like Caparossi, is they've gone from a 125 to a 250 to a 500 to a 990, and now there's back to an 800, and he's gone from different teams. So, you know, if you're going to be around that long, you might not be winning every race, but you have shown that you can adapt to a different bike, and he's doing better, I think, on a Suzuki so far this year.
Right. I agree. I tend to think of him that way. I still find it a little weird to see Lewis Caparossi on the powder blue Suzuki. You know, I just sort of expect to see him, you know, riding a, if not a red Ducati, then a, like a black West Honda Pons, wasn't it? Team, you know, the Honda Pons team that he,
right,
you know, way back when, and that sort of thing. So it just seems strange to see, you know, his number on the, that powder blue looking, thing. But again, in world championship points, he's doing much better than his teammate, you know, 51 points to 11 points as far thus far this season. And,
He's one of those riders we talked about that are kind of battling right now between sixth and ninth place.
Right.
You know, he's in eighth place right now, but he's only 6 points out of sixth place. So it's going to be interesting to see how as the season goes on. And, you know, I think he'll get a little bit better on that Suzuki the first part of the year. It's just, you know, he's just starting off. I think his results will improve. And so I wouldn't be surprised to see him move up to seventh or sixth place in the standings.
Right, which is, and the thing is, oh, you know, seventh or sixth place and all that. But this came up in a previous call as well. Again, you're looking for the 18 best motorcycle riders in the world, right? Okay, and so even if you throw in, like, you know, somewhat the oddball teams like JIR or Team KR when they were here or whatever, so you've got a couple that are a little bit edgy as far as the teams are concerned. Even so, you're still talking about certainly the top 15 motorcycle riders in the world, right? And any other series, you know, Lewis Caparossi would be a dominant force. And here, because there is a Valentino Rossi, a Danny Pedrosa, a Casey Stoner, you know, he's relegated to, you know, eighth in the world championship standings, just because there's that many guys that are just a little bit better than he is, you know.
And let's not forget, 2 years ago, he was in the lead in the championship.
Oh, yeah.
I don't want to say halfway through, but, you know, after, I think, 4 or 5 or 6 races, and then he got injured. And, you know, a lot of people, including myself, think if he hadn't gotten injured and hadn't missed a few races, it's very well that instead of Nicky Hayden winning the championship, it would have been him.
Right, exactly. And and Lewis Caparossi, Max Biaggi is in the same boat. These are guys who had the misfortune of being in MotoGP and the 500cc class and all of that at the same time as Valentino Rossi. So when you've got a guy that's taking five championships in a row, you know, it's just there's none left. So it's right. Like Randy Mamola back in the early 90s. It's like these other guys. It's like these are the best riders ever to not get a championship.
Right.
and it's just because there was that guy who was that much better.
Yep.
And last thing
I wanted to mention was Tony Elias.
Yes.
He got flagged. And the only thing I wanted to mention about that was, I think he got black flagged for jumping the start.
Right.
And, the commentators were saying that, he must have, because he didn't see the black flag soon enough. He was supposed to do a ride-through penalty. He went around three laps. He didn't come into the pits. And then they black flagged him. And right when they black flagged him, he came into the pits. And they showed him doing a ride-through penalty. And the commentators were like, I'm not sure what he's doing. I'm not sure if he's just ignoring the black flag and going back out. But the one thing I wanted to mention was, when you're a rider and it's the first few laps, you've got a lot of people around you, I'm always surprised that I wouldn't be surprised at all if he doesn't see his pit board. You have such a short period of time to actually see the pit board or a black flag or whatever they're showing to him to show that he was penalized on the front straight, that it wasn't surprising to me that he probably just missed it.
I think he did.
And when he did see it, he said, okay, I'll come in this next lap. And that by that point, it was the third time, and they had already black flagged him. So I think there was some confusion on that, and I don't think it was – the commentators were saying, well, maybe he's just – he knows he's on the Ducati and he doesn't really want to be out there, so he's just going to run it until he gets black flag. I don't think it's that at all. I think those riders, even somebody who's finishing in 16th and 17th place, they know they only have a certain number of race laps that they can adapt to and learn from. And, I don't think they're out there just to kind of say, screw you, I'm just going to ride until you black flag me and then call it a day.
I agree. I didn't think that was fair of the commentators. For one, okay, the rule is you have three laps, I believe, to come in for your ride through, and the first three laps are different than the middle three laps.
Yeah.
And two, did you see the size of the board? Okay, when they actually black flagged him, they gave you a really good shot of one guy holding the black flag, and he's got it stretched out, black flag, big old black flag. And that black flag is probably 2.5 feet across. It's a big flag, right? And then there's a guy holding this thing that's like a clipboard with the rider's like number on it.
Yeah, it's like a little whiteboard.
Right.
It looks like it's about 18 inches by 11 inches.
If that.
And it looks like somebody hand wrote on that board some number.
His number,
and,
right.
just a few weeks ago, I did a little mini endurance race. And I know from just doing that little mini endurance race, we have a pit board. And it's a full-size pit board. And we've got numbers on yellow numbers on a black background. We make it as easy as possible to see. It's as big as the boards that they use in MotoGP. And at PIR, where I race, it's a long front straightaway. You've got lots of time to look over. And I'm probably going 50 miles an hour slower than they are on MotoGP bikes. My bike only goes to like 165. And it's still hard to see that board.
Right. Right. I'm totally on board with you. This is, again, about the track days, because I wanted to touch on our track day a little bit. So we might as well do this as a segue. You come back in after a session, and I hear people saying, who was that out there on the R1, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm like, I'm a little mind boggled that these people can realize that motorcycle that just passed them or that they were right next to or whatever, that was an R1. I've heard much, not even R1 because, that's relatively, but, there's a guy that does the track days with us who took an FZ1 and put a lot of R1 bits on it, right? So he's got kind of an R1 FZ1 hybrid kind of thing going on.
Right.
And somebody came in from a session and described this motorcycle. He says, it's like an R1, but not really, and this and that. And I'm like, how can you tell this at 145 miles an hour? Because I have no idea. I couldn't even tell you what color the bike was. So
yeah, I'm the same blue as you. I can't pick that stuff out. I am amazed sometimes. You'll talk to some, the Kona workers, they're amazing on certain aspects. And, as a racer, I give all the credit I can to corner workers whenever possible, but I know some people are like, they're corner workers, some racers, I should say, are like, they're corner workers, they're not really racers, they don't give them the same respect as another racer, but on their own level, they can pick out bikes by the sound and by the look. It's really pretty incredible, because when I'm out there just watching races, I can't pick that stuff up at all.
Well, especially when they're in a pack. I mean, I can tell if I have a little bit of a gap going on and everything, I can hear the differences of the sound. And with a race series that I'm really in tune with, like MotoGP, I can tell by the colors of the bikes and all that sort of thing and follow this stuff. But like we were talking about before the call, neither of us has been following the 250cc's closely enough that, you know, you see these motorcycles and you're not sure, is that Battista or Simoncelli, you know, because of, you know, those aren't the best example perhaps because of, you know, the colors of the bikes, but so many of the motorcycles look the same and, you know, and you just see this pretty quick, you know,
right,
zoom by sort of a thing. And especially if both motorcycles are moving at, you know, at 150 or whatever plus miles an hour, going into corners and things like that, it's like I got a whole lot of other stuff to think about before I figure out what that motorcycle is. And certainly, going back to the original premise, if I was Tony Elias trying to read this little tiny thing, you know, I agree. That's actually a rule that should be reexamined. You know, if it's within the first, I don't know, I don't think that's unreasonable to say. If it's in the first five laps of the race, you have 5 laps to come in, and if
it might not give them the whole race. Like, well, who cares if you come in? It's a ride-through penalty. No matter at what point in the race you do a ride-through penalty, it's a ride-through penalty. You're pretty much screwed the rest of the race. It doesn't matter if it's the first 3 laps or the last 3 laps.
Yeah.
So, you know, why? You know, it doesn't matter if he gets penalized for a false start. Maybe he doesn't want to come in until lap 10. You know, it doesn't really make much sense to me. Like I said, a ride-through penalty is a good enough penalty. It's basically a 10-second penalty or more.
Some of those
pit lanes are so long, and they have to have a controlled speed all the way through. And another point to this is that, you know, and there's a rule in the books that says there's no communication between the rider and the pits, you know, over an intercom, or not intercom, but over radio. And it seems like there should be a few exceptions to that, and one of the exceptions should be for penalizing, you know, when you get penalized and you have to come in, there should be something that just goes off in your helmet when you're going down the front straight that says you've been penalized, you need to come in. So
Sure. You
don't even need to look over at the wall. And I think they also should have some kind of communication for, you know, during rain races so they can kind of say, hey, it's raining, you know, we've got tires, and you can tell the team, I need these kind of tires. I don't need full wets. I need partial wets or whatever. They have the ability, and I don't see why they don't make that. I kind of understand that they, you know, there's a reason why they don't have it, you know, communication for the entire race. But there should be some exceptions.
Yeah, that makes sense. I was kind of, because I enjoy watching Formula One, as people know, and part of Formula One is hearing the ship to shore communication, and I'd always said, you know, that, well, they should have that at MotoGP. And actually David Emmett over there at Kropotkin changed my mind of the way things with his, you know, very good argument that he made. And this was several months ago. And I was like, you know, you're right. That it's not something that in MotoGP, but realistically having it's like a buzzer or a, you know, beep, 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 beep in your helmet or something like that. Hey, you've been penalized, you know, pay attention. You know, you need to read the board or whatever to know you've got a ride through or whatever it is. Right. Which
or,
it almost,
or a light on your dash. That just
a light on the dash.
Yellow.
Sure. Right. And, exactly. And in that thing, if you're talking a rain race, these riders do things. They change their engine mappings and all that sort of stuff. It shouldn't be all that difficult to have a simple, not a real communication system where the guy's actually talking to the pits and saying, you know, I want these kind of tires, but a one or two choice button arrangement. And so then the teams have to sort of have a thing. Okay, well, you push button number one if you want full wets. You push button number two if you want intermediates or whatever it is, right? And this would be another team effort thing, whereas how well did these guys organize this that they have such a limited form of communication that all they can choose is one, two, or three. And, you know, so it starts to rain, the rider pushes button number two, and the team knows that they've got, you know, one lap or two laps or whatever to prep the bike for the way the rider wants it.
Right. And like you say, I mean, there's arguments for and against, and I can understand somebody's arguments for and against as far as, you know, ship-to-shore communication during a race or during a regular race or during a rain race. But it just seems kind of a no-brainer that if you're going to be penalized, it's not a team communication. This is the track organizer saying you're penalized. You need to do a ride-through penalty, and you only have 3 laps in order to come in. then there's no, I don't see a reason why they shouldn't have some kind of communication. And like you say, maybe not actually telling the rider, but just have a signal on the, you know, a light on the dash or something that flashes that, you know, you get this red light in your dash, you know, oh, I made a mistake. I need to do a ride through.
Right, right, exactly. Although I'd be surprised if the team on the pit board, when he was having his ride through, you know, the team was probably putting up his pit board with a big ass ride through or something like that as well. You know,
but still, like you say, it's the first few laps. It's the heat of the competition. And those, I know from experience, you just can't see that pit board. I'm amazed that they have as much communication that they as they do on the pit board. And it's just, you know, it's silly.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, actually, you see the pit boards, and there's a lot of information on there. You know, you've got the gap between the guy in front of you, the gap behind you, and, you know, little tiny, relatively tiny arrows, you know, up and down and all that sort of thing. And that's a lot of information to absorb as you zoom by at 190 or 200 miles an hour down the front straight.
And, and what I think is actually happening there is they put up all that information and the rider is only looking at one piece of that.
Right.
You know, they know what, so for example, if the rider comes around and the rider knows that he's in P3, well, he knows that they're going to have P3 on the top of the board. He's going to ignore that. He's concerned about the information he wants to look at. If he wants to know who's behind him and how far they are, he's going to look at the bottom of the board. So I don't think the rider is digesting all of that information on the board. He's picking and choosing what he wants to look at. I mean, it goes by at a flash at a second. I mean, it's up for so short of a period of time. You're going by that, like you say, at like 190 miles an hour. You don't have time to read that whole thing.
I agree. And for a comparison, let's take the average driver out there on the road that has the sign that says, hey, lane's ending in a mile or whatever, the construction sign. And these people are driving at 60 or 65 miles an hour, right? And they can't seem to absorb that much information. So figure a sign that is one quarter the size of that road sign and going by four times as fast. So exactly. Now, granted, the MotoGP rider is not on the cell phone. He's not applying makeup, and he's not eating a quarter pounder. But all those other distractions aside, what's that?
Not that we know of, at least.
Yes, yes. I have not yet seen Valentino Rossi enjoying a quarter pounder as he goes down the front straight. Although I think that he would do it if he thought it was a suitable, you know, victory celebration sort of a thing.
Well, it wouldn't be called a quarter pounder. It would be called a la Royale.
A Royale with cheese, yes. Saw that movie too, huh? So, well, we're really running out of time. So why don't we hold our track day conversation for another day, unless you got something that was just really cogent that you wanted to throw out there. Cause I did want to talk about the track day. We just finished a track day, guys. I was up there with Darren and Fergus for my first track day of the season. You've already done a couple this year, haven't you, Darren?
I've done a few, but like you say, we've run out of time. We can continue. I don't want to cut that short. There's a pretty few information we want to give out. It's good talking. Maybe we'll have to wait till later. We'll make some notes and talk about it in December when there's nothing going on. Or
even August, the August break, because the track days are good stuff, and I do. I want to give it fair and reasonable coverage. So like I said, unless you've got something that just has to be said right now, we will hold off on that.
Very good.
And all right. It's been a super fun call, Darren. Thanks to you. Thanks to Jim Garrison very much for supplying the beer for this evening's call. I very much enjoyed it. Some good stuff so far that I've tried. And Darren, the barley wine was tasty?
It was very tasty. I liked it very much.
Good deal.
And, you know, for listeners out there, send your beer to Bob and send your very expensive hard liquor to me.
Yeah, there you go. and even the beer, you know, I share and share alike. So when I next actually physically run into Darren, I will share it out with him. But all right, thanks a lot, Darren. We'll call it a day, and we'll talk to you next time.
Very good, Bob.
Well, it's been a while since I've done an editorial, so I'm going to do one of these. This is not quite a rant. Like I said, it's more of an editorial. And what I'm going to talk about this time is passing. And what brought this on is if you happen to catch Wind Tunnel with Dave Despain on Speed TV, which here in the United States, we have a show called Wind Tunnel. And Dave Despain is a noted motorsports analyst, that kind of thing. And he does a show. It's a, basically a call-in talk show called Wind Tunnel. And I used to watch it all the time, but it's gotten more and more and more sort of NASCAR-y. So pretty much now I very rarely watch it unless I happen to realize that there's a good guest or something like that coming along. So this episode, they advertised that there was going to be Bob Varsha and Peter Windsor, who are part of the Speed Formula One announcing team. Peter Windsor, I'm sure any Formula One fans out there have heard of Peter Windsor. And you know, if you're in the United States and you watch Formula One, you probably heard of Bob Varsha. So they had Bob Varsha and Peter Windsor on there talking about the Canadian Grand Prix and all of that. Then they kind of surprised Peter Windsor with a special secret guest who turned out to be Darrell Waltrip, who's a former NASCAR Winston Cup or whatever cup it was called at the time, champion back like in the 80s and stuff. And now he's also an announcer for Speed and, you know, kind of he's the Peter Windsor of NASCAR, if you will. And basically, the gist of the whole thing was that Peter Windsor is known for making comments like, you know, if you want to see a lot of senseless passing and overtaking for the lead, then why don't you watch, you know, NASCAR or IRL or motorcycle racing or that sort of thing. Saying that, and Peter Windsor made his points here on the Wind Tunnel, that passing is not necessarily good racing, that in order to have a good race, you don't have to have lots of passing. And the way he made his point, actually, I thought made a certain amount of sense. And I sort of said, yeah, you know, he's a little bit right there. Basically, he compared it to fishing. And he says, if you go fishing and you catch 55 fish every day, then it's not all that special. But if you go out there and you, you know, you fish all day and you catch this, you know, big monster, 3 foot, whatever the hell it is, and you go home and you enjoy it and all that sort of thing, then that makes the fishing that much more special because, you know, you did your thing and you caught that fish. So I thought, you know, that makes a certain amount of sense. And I'm not saying I necessarily totally agree with Peter Windsor, but I do see what he's saying. And especially when you apply this to Formula One, which is a completely different sort of racing than MotoGP, because we're not talking about the Formula One and NASCAR comparison that they had going on in that episode of Wind Tunnel. We're talking here about MotoGP, of course. And the he's right in a sense that part of the excitement, the fun of watching Formula One is the whole strategy. Watching someone set, you know, watching a driver set another driver up for lap after lap after lap, and maybe even some pit stops and all that sort of thing, and finally making a pass that sticks. And that's just, it's very satisfying. It's very exciting. It's like, wow, look, he did that. You know, so I found myself somewhat seeing his point, not necessarily agreeing with him, but understanding where he was coming from. The point I want to make here is that, and I will get to my point, but the point that I want to make here is that where Peter Windsor compared passing in Formula One to fishing, I don't think that's an apt analogy for MotoGP. I think that what we need to compare it to here, and I actually came up with a couple different comparisons, but since this is a relatively PG-rated show and I know there are younger listeners out there, I'm going to compare it to pizza. Now, you might say to yourself, passing, pizza? What's the connection there? There is no connection. But no, this is not true. Because just like you may not want to have pepperoni pizza all the time, you can always change it up and get, you know, ham and pineapple, right? So we have varieties of pizza. And just as with pizza, I think we have varieties of passing, particularly in MotoGP. Motorcycle racing is a lot different than auto racing because there's so many different lines to take into any corner. And even if there is only one line, because motorcycles are so narrow, there's room often for two motorcycles to get into a corner, and it's particularly with some of these sort of S curves that we have going on at a lot of tracks nowadays, you know, side by side passing, and you just don't see that with cars because the cars are wider and they're taking up a lot more of the physical road space on the course, and it's just a procession, whereas in motorcycle racing this is not the case. So made up a little list of a few different kinds of passing that I kind of thought of real quick on a whim in MotoGP, and I want you to see what you think of this, and of course send in more suggestions or say, you know, no, Bob, you're crazy or whatever. But first, of course, we have the mistake pass. Okay, the leader, and this may or may not be a pass for the lead, and this is one thing where we could get into a whole big discussion about passing for the lead as opposed to passing farther down the order. But right now, we're just talking about passing in general. And wherever the race, you know, the camera is focused, and so you're watching the race and you're seeing the racing like we saw at Catalunya, where really the race was for second, and that was the excitement. But it was a very exciting race, and I found myself on the edge of the seat. So, first type of pass, the mistake pass. Lead rider fumbles it one way or the other. Something happened. He screwed up. So he goes wide on a corner, and the passing rider that's right behind him takes advantage of that and goes underneath him and makes the pass. Now, whether or not he makes that pass stick for any length of time or not, yeah, it's somewhat of a different story. But that's the first kind of pass that I'm talking about. And you could compare that to, like, you know, cheese pizza, relatively nondescript. And then let's see. The next kind of pass you might think about would be the late on the brakes type of pass. And this is where the passing rider, the guy that's behind, of course, the leading rider, is just braver on the brakes. And he stuffs it in. And he goes into that corner, and he's so late on the brakes that he can make a pass on the opposing rider, the leading rider. However, you will find that on that pass, a lot of the times, the leading rider can quickly regain the lead because, you know, because of a variety of different reasons. The passing rider has, he got ahead of him for a little bit, but that slowed him down because he late apexed and all that sort of thing. And so we often see this sort of pass not end up sticking. And, you know, that's another kind of pizza, right? So one night you might feel like that kind of pizza. One day you might feel like the other kind of pizza. But I thought it was an interesting analogy. I'm going to run with it. Then let's see. The other one that I had here, the ones I was typing thinking about, was the stuffing it underneath. So the leading rider is apexing at the sort of, he's taking the correct racing line. He's doing a good job. He thinks everything's fine, but he's left a tiny gap open. Okay, and I mean, some riders, this can be an extremely tiny gap. I remember the race a few races ago. I can't remember the exact circuit, but James Toseland was taking a pass on, someone or other. And it was unbelievable. You know, it's just like, wow, where did he find any track to go right there? You know, he's basically on the rumble strip. The tiniest door was left open, and he stuffed it right under and made the pass stick. You know, you're bashing fairings, all that sort of things. Now, this takes a lot of bravery and possibly some foolishness on the part of the passing rider. And also, I think, a lot of trust, which we saw in the 250cc race with Barbera and Simoncelli at Mugello. But the trust may or may not always be there. But in any case, this is yet another kind of pass, correct? And I just thought, yeah, you know, there's one to go on. Now, of course, the next kind of pass that we can talk about is the draft pass, where one motorcycle basically is drafting behind another, and because he's got, you know, a little bit of additional power because he's been drafting at the end of the straight, he can make the pass there at the end of the straight. And actually, this pass probably should have come up a little earlier in my list of passes because, let's face facts, relatively speaking, it's one of the less exciting passes. This is a, you know, I mean, it can be extremely exciting, and it can be very technically difficult and all that sort of thing. But on the other hand, a lot of times it's just he's sort of taking advantage of the fact that he's got a little bit of extra room because he'd been drafting behind the other guy. So he's got a little bit extra power, I should say, not room. And he can go out there and make the pass stick. And there's the related pass where simply one motorcycle has more straight line horsepower than the other. And you'll see that one a lot too. But then oftentimes is not, just like with the late on the brakes pass, that pass comes to naught in the end because the passed motorcycle just retakes the lead because they might have something more going on in the corners than the motorcycle that's trying to do it strictly on power. And then, of course, the last kind of pass that we're going to talk about is the one that Peter Windsor talks about, that being very sort of satisfying and the sort of thing that you watch motorcycle racing for, and this is what I want to see, and that's the true setup pass. And Rossi is the classic example of the guy that can do this, where he stalks his prey lap after lap and watches where their weak points are, sees what's going on, and then eventually makes a pass and makes it stick because he has analyzed the victim, if you will, and he knows what he can do. And, of course, this is the kind of pass that Peter Windsor was referring to as being the most satisfying and or the best or what have you. And I think it is in MotoGP as well. This is the one where you've been watching and you're just, you know, you're jumping up and down. And yeah, go get it. But all of these passes are in their own way very, very exciting and very, very satisfying and very, very much part of why we watch motorcycle racing. So to say that too much passing, too much overtaking is senseless and gratuitous and all of that sort of thing, I think is a bit, I'm not sure the word facetious or just, it's just, I don't agree with it. But on the other hand, we're talking motorcycle racing versus Formula One versus other types of racing like say NASCAR or something like that. And I'm not that familiar with NASCAR. I am, however, more than a casual fan of Formula One. And I do understand Peter Windsor's position because in Formula One, you have things like pit stops and all that sort of stuff that contributes so much to the strategy of the overall race that this can make it where, yes, it's a bit like a chess game. And we're watching and, oh, wow, look, he got out of the pits and just in the right time. And they had a 7-second pit stop or what have you. And then they pitted in the right lap and all this kind of business. And it sort of all comes together to make for an interesting race where you can admire what a fantastic team effort this sort of a thing is. MotoGP, we don't have pit stops. Most motorcycle racing doesn't have pit stops. We're not talking about endurance racing or Isle of Man style real road racing, if you will, or the Daytona 200, any of those sort of things. But in a MotoGP race, it's pretty much a heat race. You go out there and you race as hard as you can, fast as you can, for roughly odd about 40 minutes or so, and whoever crosses the finish line first, the winner. So if we did not have passing like we do in MotoGP, then it becomes much less of an interesting spectacle. And so I think that although the wind tunnel Peter Windsor versus Darrell Waltrip conversation was dealing with car racing, I do want to throw in my two cents as far as motorcycle racing is concerned. And I think that his comments were, you know, are clearly out of place for motorcycle racing. And if he does say something like that, if you want to see a lot of passing and shunts and all that sort of thing, that you should watch motorcycle racing, blah, 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 that I think he's dead wrong on that. So now, yes, granted, it is two different disciplines, two different kinds of racing, but I think that MotoGP passing is extraordinarily important. And rather than comparing it to fishing, I'm going to compare it to pizza, because there's just more than one kind of pizza. And sometimes you feel like pepperoni, sometimes you feel like ham and pineapple, sometimes you might even feel like a veggie. Whatever it is, you have it in MotoGP. And that is this week's editorial. All right, thanks very much for downloading the show. I hope you enjoyed it. Appreciate you tuning in. One thing I neglected to mention in my little editorial is that in the show notes at MotoGPOD.com, there will be a link to an iTunes download, and you can download that section of Wind Tunnel that has Peter Windsor and Darrell Waltrip doing their sort of back and forth thing about passing and all of that. And it's actually kind of interesting, particularly when you hear Peter Windsor make his analogy of fishing, which came out so much better and smoother than my pizza analogy, even though I had it all planned perfectly in my head of how I was going to talk about it. And there's also those articles by Dennis Noyes about Ben Spies that I mentioned in our call with Darren. And that's, those links are up there on MotoGPOD.com. So check that out. And let's see, I think that's going to about do it. We will be talking to you again next Friday, which is going to be June 20th. And at that time, we will wrap up the race that will have already occurred, the World Superbike race, because they're going to, where is World Superbike going this weekend here? World Superbike racing at, first time that they've raced there, in quite a few years at the Nürburgring. So World Superbike's going to Nürburgring this weekend, and we'll talk about that again next week a little bit, probably. And other than that, we'll also have a preview show for the exciting MotoGP race at Donington, one of my favorite tracks, and certainly one of Rossi's. So that's going to be happening the following week, which is the weekend of June 21st and June 22nd. So, until then, why don't you keep the shiny side up, and we will talk to you later. MotoGPOD is produced by Bob Hayes, and I'm solely responsible for its content. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL. The MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners, and MotoGPOD is not affiliated with any of them.